Blog
I was going to start off with a poem, but I
just a brief biography for those who may not know Robert Frost's work or his life. And I'm going to read this brief. It's a long introduction, but I'm going to cut it short here and edit it a bit. But this book by Louis Untermeyer, okay, was a kind of an enlarged anthology of Robert Frost's poems. I'll be reading from some of those possibly tonight, but I really wanted to read the introduction here of Robert Frost. So Robert Frost, the man and the poet. The character as well as the career of Robert Frost gives the lie to the usual misconceptions of the poet. Frost has been no less the ordinary man for being an extraordinary creator. The creator, the artist, and the extraordinary man is merely the ordinary man intensified. A person whose life is sometimes lifted to a high pitch of feeling and who has the gift of making others share his excitement. The ordinary man lives by the creative spirit. He thinks in images and dreams and fantasy. He lives by poetry. Yet he seems to distrust it. He clings to the notion that a poet is a queer and incompetent creature, a daydreaming ne'er-do-well, an eccentric trying to escape the business of everyday world, a soft and coddled soul. Almost the opposite is true. History is the record of men who were not only poets, but workers, men of action, discoverers, dreamers, and doers. Sir Walter Raleigh, his exploration of Ghana and other expeditions in the New World brought him fame and envy. Sir Philip Sidney was a soldier whose gallantry on the field of battle is a deathless story. And Geoffrey Chaucer, father of English poetry, was a diplomat and a secret agent on the king's business in Europe. John Milton was Cromwell's fighting foreign secretary. Nor have poets failed in labor and industry. Ben Jonson was a bricklayer. Robert Herrick was a jeweler. Robert Burns was a plowboy. William Blake designed, printed, and sold his own books. William Morris manufactured furniture long before he became known as the greatest American poet of his time. Robert Frost worked as a farmer, a bobbin boy in Massachusetts mill, a shoemaker, and a teacher in country schools. Any account of Robert Frost's life must begin with its courageous contradictions. Descended from a long line of New Englanders who were rooted in the region since 1632, Frost was born in California. The most American of poets, he was first recognized not in his own country, but abroad, and his first two books were published in England. He has never entered a competition and does not believe in prize contests, yet the Pulitzer Prize for the best poetry of the year has been awarded to him four times. Now, again, he was alive when this book was actually published as anthology. And, this was published in 1946, right? And again published originally, and then again published again, and again. And his last publication date was one I have here as 1971. So let me just go on here. He never entered a competition and does not believe in prize contests. Yet the Pulitzer Prize for the best poetry of the year has been awarded to him four times. His blank verse monologues are supposed to be written in the rough conversational tones of speech. Yet his lyrics are remarkable for their delicate and precise music. He has chosen one part of the country for his special province. The very titles of this book seem local, north of Boston, mountain interval, New Hampshire, a further range, yet no poetry so regional has ever been so universal. And Robert Frost's ancestors were Scotch-Irish. His mother was of Scottish seafaring family, a school teacher, whose name appears in most records as Isabel Moody. Frost was more than 50 when he learned the correct spelling from a distant cousin in New Zealand. The relation from down under informed him that the proper spelling was Moody, M-O-O-D-I. And a few years later, the poet acknowledged the correction in a poem which serves as motto for a witness tree, a poem playfully signed the Moody Forester. And a restless and sometimes rebellious spirit possessed Frost's father. Family hoped the William Prescott Frost would be a lawyer, but he became a teacher, then an editor, and then a politician. Revolting from the Republican New England, Frost's father went to the West Coast and worked on the San Francisco Bulletin, a Democratic newspaper. And during the Civil War, he was proud to be a Copperhead, a Southern sympathizer, and a champion of states' rights. And when his son was born on March 26, 1874, the child was named after the great Southern soldier and scholar and Christian Robert Lee Frost. The San Francisco of Frost's youth was a rough town. Westerners sported revolvers as jauntily as Easterners carried canes. And although Frost's father enjoyed the hazardous life of editor-politician in a boisterous community, his health did not stand the strain. And when he died of tuberculosis in his early 30s, the boy Robert was 10 years old. And taken back by his mother to New England of his ancestors, the fatherless boy grew into the independent young man. His mother taught school and read to him, and the first story he ever read through for himself was The Scottish Chiefs. The second was Tom Brown's School Days. He was then 14, a late starter with books. And it's kind of long, and it's very, very fascinating. But biography on him, and there's a lot of great poems in this book. But I wanted to go to the start with a few poems that I've selected tonight for their and it's from they're from In the Clearing. In the Clearing. And I'll start with The Pod of the Milkweed. Calling all butterflies of every race, from source unknown but from no special place, they ever will return to all their lives, because unlike the bees, they have no hives. The milkweed brings up to my very door the theme of wanting waste and peace and war, as it has never been to me before. And so it seems of flowers coming out that should, if not be taught, then sung about. Countless wings that from the infinite make such a noiseless tumult over it. Do not doubt with their color compensate for what the drab weed lacks of the ornate. For drab it is, its fondest must admit. And yes, although it is a flower that flows with milk and honey, it is bitter milk. As anyone who ever broke its stem and dared to taste the wound a little knows. It tastes as if it might be opiate. But whatsoever else it may secrete, its flowers, distilled honey, is so sweet, it makes the butterflies intemperate. There is no slumber in its juice for them. No knocks. One knocks another off from where he clings. They knock the dry stuff off each other's wings with thirst and hunger to the point of lust. They raise in their intemperance a cloud of mingled butterfly and flower dust. that hangs imperceptibly above the scene. In being sweet to these ephemerals, sober weed has managed to contrive in our 300 days and 65, one day too sweet for beings to survive. Many shall come away as struggle-worn and spent and dusted off of their regalia, to which at daybreak they are freshly born, as after one of them proverbial failure, from having beaten all day long in vain against the wrong side of a window pane. But waste was of the essence of the scheme, and all that good they did for man or God, to all those flowers they passionately trod, was leave as their posterity one pod, with an inheritance of restless dream. He hangs on upside down with taloned feet in an inquisitive position odd, as a Guatemalan parakeet. Something eludes him. It is food to eat, or some dim secret of the good of waste. He almost has it in his taloned clutch. Where have those flowers and butterflies all gone that science may have staked the future on? He seems to say the reason why so much should come to nothing must be fairly faced. And it's really quite Frostian, if you will. But how I love that he takes nature and is able to perceive man's plight as part of nature and part of the world and part of the strangeness of it all, intermingled with his own life and his own thoughts, and leaving us with the question, answered yet, allowing us to still ponder the beauty of the image, you know. And poetry is an extremely personal journey for those who write it as well as for those who read it. And what I love about Frost, and always have, was that he was, you know, being from New England, being raised in New England, and having knowing the states and then knowing the terrain and knowing the people, I of course have a tendency to be fond of his work and understand it. But I believe that everybody can. Anybody who can appreciate a flower or an insect or a sky, you know, or a tree, you know, which are all things that he writes about. So his work is really quite, though it's regional, it's very, very much universal. And that's why he was so acclaimed as a poet. The next poem I wanted to read was Away. Now I out walking the world desert, and my shoe and my stocking do not hurt. I leave behind good friends in town, let them get well wined and go lie down. Don't think I leave for the outer dark like Adam and Eve put out of the park. Forget the myth, there is no one, I am put out with or put out by. Unless I'm wrong, I but obey the urge of a song, I'm bound away. And I may return if dissatisfied with what I learned from having died. And opportunity, I don't think it needs much explanation there. But I love you. You have to appreciate, people don't write like this anymore. Poetry is not so metered, you know. But Frost also wrote many blank verse poems, and I hope to be able to read some tonight. There's one more that I wanted to read here from this segment. And it's called America is Hard to See. It's a little long, but I think it's an important poem. America is hard to see. Columbus may have worked the wind, a new and better way to end, and also proved the world a ball, but how about the wherewithal? Not just for scientific news had the Queen backed him to a cruise. Remember, he had made the test, finding the East by sailing west. But had he found it? Here he was, without one trinket from Ormuz, to save the Queen from family censure for her investment in his venture. There had been something strangely wrong with every coast he tried along. He could imagine nothing barrener. The trouble was with him, the mariner. He wasn't off a mere degree. His reckoning was off a sea. And to intensify the drama, another mariner, Da Gama, came just then sailing into port from the same general resort, and with the golden hand to show for his claim, it was another Ofar. Had but Columbus known enough, he might have boldly made the bluff that better than Da Gama's gold, he had been given to behold the race's future trial place, a fresh start for the human race. He might have fooled Valladolid. I was deceived by what he did. If I had had my chance when young, I should have had Columbus sung as a god who had given us a more than Moses Exodus. But all he did was spread the rumor of our enacting out the doom of being in each other's way, and so put off the weary day when we would have to put our mind on how to crowd but still be kind. To these none too apparent gains, he got no more than dungeon chains, and such small posthumous renown, a country named for him, a town, a holiday, as where he is, he may not recognize for his. They say his flagship, unlaid ghost, still probes and dents our rocky coasts with animus approaching hate, and for not turning out a strait, he has cursed every river mouth from 50 north to 50 south. And someday our navy, I predict, will take in tow his derelict and lock him through a cobra cut. The eyes as good or bad as shut to all the modern works of man and all we call American. America is hard to see. Less partial witnesses than he, in book on book after have testified, then could not see it from outside, or inside either for that matter. We know the literary chatter. Columbus, as I say, will miss all he owes to the artifice. Of tractor plow and motor drill, to not but this, but his own force of will, or at most some Aedean quake, will he ascribe his lucky break. And high purpose makes the hero rude, He will not stop for gratitude, but let him know his haughty stern to what was never his concern, except as it denied him way to fortune hunting in Cathay. You will be starting pretty late. You'll find that Asiatic state is about tired of being looted or having its beliefs disputed. And he can be no such easy raid as Cortez or the Aztecs made. And this poem's a little, remember the language is a little old. However, the concept of seeing America, even by Columbus, though he didn't really see America, he saw the West Indies. But it is in a euphemistic way, we don't see America either. We don't understand America. Even though we live in America, we don't understand our fellow citizens. We don't appreciate the tremendous gift that this country is to its people. And of course, Columbus could never have seen it for what it is today, and most people could not. Even in the last, I'd say even in the last 50 years, this country has changed so much in its politics and its landscape and its methods of farming. I recall flying over the United States years ago and to the West Coast, and I are actually into the Rocky Mountains up in Montana. And flying from the east to west and flying over these massive stretches of flat farmland and perfect, I mean, it just went on and on and on and on forever. It took me 8 hours to get there, but I mean, it was like, by flight, but it was just remarkable, you know, just a remarkable thing to see the land beneath, see America, how big it is and how laid out it is and how marvelous it is and overwhelming. And these city after city, farmland after forest and mountains and lakes and oceans, and my God, it's just mind-boggling when you consider the scale, the massive scale of this country. I mean, and the tremendous gifts that we have. So you know, from what I'm saying, America really is hard to see. Taking Frost. Words very, very hard to see, but it's also America is also a not just, you can't just see it, you know, you have to feel it, and you feel it. It's a spirit, and it's a tremendous spirit that you know we steward. As American citizens, and unfortunately, we are such poor stewards of this great gift, this great land, that you know we just I'm at a total loss for words when I try to. Describe the immensity of this landmass that's North America here, that's America, and the bounty, you know, the riches, the wealth, that just is overwhelming, you know, and not only in food, but in all of its incredible natural resources that, of course, we plunder daily, and, you know, just again, it seems to be an endless supply, and it's such a remarkable gift to us, America. And this, I believe, was something that Frost was trying to relay in this, how hard it is, even for the original founders, to see, you know, how short-sighted we all are when it comes to the size and scope of what America is and what America can be. And, that's why I read this poem tonight, and it was because it symbolizes that. It's only... Here's what good poetry does. What I liked about Frost is not only did he write long poems, but he wrote short ones as well. And I want to read a couple of short ones. Escapist, never. He is so fugitive. He is no fugitive. Escaped, escaping. No one has seen him stumble looking back. His fear is not behind him, but beside him. On either hand, to make his course, perhaps, a crooked straightness, yet no less a straightness. He runs fast. He runs face forward. He is a pursuer. He seeks a seeker who in his turn seeks another still, lost far into the distance. Any who seek him seek in him the seeker. His life is a pursuit of a pursuit forever. It is the future that creates his present. All is an interminable chain of longing. And we cannot escape ourselves. We cannot escape. We can temporarily. But we can take a vacation, or we can take a drink, or we can take a night out, or we can do, you know, we can fall asleep in front of the TV if you want to escape. But escaping is impossible. We can't escape. We can't escape death. If we're alive, we obviously couldn't escape birth. And we can't escape suffering, and we can't escape joy, and we can't escape all of the experiences that we are here to live and experience. So, but the escapist, never. That's what this short poem really means. No one has seen him stumble looking back. His fear is not behind him, but beside him. On either hand, to make his course perhaps a crooked straightness, yet no less a straightness. He runs face forward. He is a pursuer. He seeks a seeker who in his turn seeks. Another still lost far into the distance. Yet who seeks him, seek in him the seeker. His life is a pursuit of a pursuit forever. It is the future that creates his present. All is an interminable chain of longing. And he's right. It's we long for whatever it is we long for. Those of you who are extremely younger, would be, you know, might have seen it on some movie or something, or not movie, but some historical movie or something. But John F. Kennedy had Robert Frost at his inauguration. And if you can remember that day, that picture of that inauguration, it was a very cold, cold day in January. And the wind was blowing and in Washington, and Robert Frost got up. And for those of you who can visualize it, you can see this picture. I've never forgotten it because I always admired the man, and I, you know, and I was young enough to remember it, and yet old enough to appreciate it. And I remember it because I was a child during that period, you know, young boy. But yet, we were all. For some reason, and I can't explain it really, but there was such a euphoria around the JFK inauguration, and because he was symbolized youth. He was our youngest president. He was 45, I believe, when he took office, and up until that time, I don't think there's been anybody younger since. I think Obama was 46 or 7 or something. But JFK, John Kennedy, was only 45 when he took office. And his he was a known intellectual. Had written many, I've written a couple of books by then, and was also a likable fellow. But the excitement around that inauguration was great, but the greatest picture that you saw was of Robert Frost. I remember it was Robert Frost at the podium with his long white hair blowing in the wind and his overcoat. And he was interrupted several times when he was reading this, and it was rather difficult for him to get through because the wind, it was very cold, windy microphone. I don't know if the microphone worked quite well. But all I remember was that he did get through it. And this is it. It's not very long. It's only a few hundred words. But I'd like to read it tonight. And he wrote it for John F. Kennedy's his inauguration. Gift outright of the gift outright. With some preliminary history in rhyme. Summoning artists to participate in the august occasion of the state seems something artists ought to celebrate. Today is for my cause a day of days, and his be poetry's old-fashioned praise. Who was the first to think of such a thing? This verse that in acknowledgement I bring goes back to the beginning of the end of what had been for centuries the trend, a turning point in modern history. Colonial had been the thing to be, as long as the great issue was to see what country'd be and one to dominate, by character, by tongue, by native trait. The new world Christopher Columbus found, the French, the Spanish, and the Dutch were drowned and counted out. His heroic deeds were done, Elizabeth the First and England won. How now came on a new order of the ages, that in the Latin of our founding sages, it is not written on the dollar bill we carry in our purse and pocket still. God nodded his approval of as good. So much those heroes knew and understood. I mean the great four, Washington, John Adams, Jefferson, and Madison. So much they knew as consecrated seers. They must have seen ahead what now appears. They would bring empires down about our ears, and by the example of our declaration, make everybody want to be a nation. And this is no autocratic joke. It's the expense of negligible folk. We see how seriously the racist swarm, and their attempts at sovereignty inform. They are our wards, they will think, to some extent, for the time being, and with their consent to teach them how democracy is meant. New orders of the ages, did we say? If it looks none too orderly today, 'tis a confusion it is ours to start. So in it have to take courageous part. No one of honest feeling would approve a ruler who pretended not to love. A turbulence he had the better of, and everyone knows the glory of the twain who gave America the aeroplane. To stand the whirlwind, and the hurricane. Some poor fool has been saying in his heart, glory is out of date in life and art. Our venture is in revolution and outlawry, has justified itself in freedom's story. Right down to now in glory upon glory. Come fresh from an election like the last, the greatest vote a people ever cast, so close yet sure to be abided by, it is no miracle our mood is high. And courage is in the air, embracing whiffs, better than all the stalemate ends and ifs. There was the book of profile tales declaring for the emboldened politicians daring to break with followers when in the wrong, a healthy independence of the throng, a democratic form of right divine, a rule first answerable to high design. There is a call to life a little sterner and braver for the earner, learner, and yearner. Less criticism of the field and court, and more preoccupation with the sport. It makes the prophet in us all presage the glory of a next Augustan age, of a power leading from its strength and pride, of young ambition eager to be tried, and firm in our free beliefs without dismay in any game the nation wants to play. A golden age of poetry and power, of which this noonday is the beginning hour. And that was the poem for John F. Kennedy's inauguration. I recall that. I remember seeing it, and I remember as a young boy, sitting in the living room watching it with my parents on television, and remembering it. It's a slice of history that I've lived through, and American history, and the tragedy. Who would have foreseen the tragedy of John F. Kennedy's murder? Still, 50 years later, not solved. And never to be unsealed. Investigation, the Warren Report, never opened until I think it's 2048 or something. So that'll be long gone by then, and probably most of you who are listening tonight will be long gone by then. But Robert Frost was there, and as the quintessential American poet of the 20th century. Such a great honor. next poem is a little short, much shorter. It's called The Gift Outright. The land was ours before we were the lands. She was our land before more than 100 years, before we were her people. She was ours in Massachusetts and Virginia, but we were England's, still colonials, possessing what we still were unpossessed by. Possessed by what we now no more possessed. Something we were withholding made us weak until we found out what it was ourselves. We were withholding from our land of living and forthwith found salvation in surrender. Such as we were, we gave ourselves outright, the deed of gift that many deeds of war, as many deeds of war, to the land vaguely realizing westward, but still unstoried, artless, and unenhanced. Such as she was, such as she would become. Of course, that's America. That's what I was saying earlier, the great gift, you know, by God. My next poem that I want to read, and I think I have time for a few more, is from this section of the book. I'm reading Robert Frost in The Clearing, if you just joined me. And this section is called The Cluster of Faith. This is the second segment of this book, the different poems. The first poem is called Accidentally on Purpose. The universe is but the thing of things, the thing but balls all going round in rings, and some of them mighty huge, some mighty tiny, all of them radiant and mighty shiny. They mean to tell us all was rolling blind, till accidentally it hit on mind in an albino monkey in a jungle, and even then it was to grope and bungle, till Darwin came to Earth upon a year to show the evolution how to steer. And they mean to tell us, though the omnibus had no real purpose till it got to us. Never believe it. At the very worst, it must have been the purpose from the first to produce purpose as the fitter bred. We were just purpose coming to a head. Whose purpose was it? His or hers or its? Let's leave that to the scientific wits. And grant me intention, purpose, and design. That's near enough for me to the divine. And yet for all this help of head and brain, how happily instinctive we remain, and how best guide upward further to the light, passionate preference, such as love at sight. And that's Robert Frost's explanation of the universe that was accidentally put together on purpose. This is kind of a clever poem. It's a clever little rhyme. And it's a never-not song, a never-not song. There was never not, there was always thought. But when noticed first, it was fairly burst into having weight. It was in a state of atomic one. Matter was begun, and in fact complete, one and yet discrete, to conflict and pair. Everything was there. Every single thing waiting was to bring clear from hydrogen all the way to men. It is all the tree it will ever be. And bole and branch and root, cunningly minute. And this gist of all is so infra-small as to blind our eyes to its every guise, and so render nil the whole Yggdrasil. Don't ask me what that word is. It's Yggdrasil. And some of coming in into having been, so the picture is caught almost next to naught but the force of thought. The next poem is quite short. The next few poems are very short. But this one is called The Version, or actually Version. Once there was an archer, and there was a minute when he shot a shaft on a new departure. Then he must have laughed. Comedy was in it. But the game he hunted was the non-existence, and his shaft got blunted on its non-resistance. Pretty clever. That was clever, I thought. And for the game he hunted was the non-existence. And his shaft got blunted on its non-resistance. So clever. And a concept self-conceived. The latest creed that has to be believed and entered in our childish catechism is all the alls a concept self-conceived, which is no more than good old pantheism. Great is the reassurance of recall. Why go on further with confusing voice to say God's either all or over all? The rule is never giving a child a choice. Forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee, and I'll forgive thy great big one on me. that kind of wit that Frost has, that ingratiates him to his readers and to the public at large. Again, I can say, forgive, O Lord, my little jokes on thee. I'll forgive thy great big one on me. Yeah, life is a big joke. Let's see, I have about 5 or 6 more minutes to go, and let's see if I can come up with something else here. Draft horse. This is quite famous. With a lantern that wouldn't burn, and too frail a buggy we drove, behind too heavy a horse, through a pitch-dark, limitless grove. And a man came out of the trees and took our horse by the head, and reaching back to his ribs, deliberately stabbed him dead. The ponderous beast went down with a crack of a broken shaft, and the night drew through the trees in one long, invidious draft. And the most unquestioning pair that ever accepted fate, and the least disposed to ascribe any more than we had to hate. We assumed that the man himself, or someone he had to obey, wanted us to get down and walk the rest of the way. You gotta love that. You gotta love that wit. You know. the image so dark and deep. to hate. We assume that the man himself, on someone or someone he had to obey, wanted us to get down and walk the rest of the way. I guess if you have to accept a shock to your system, you know, you overcome some incredible thing, you know, like come out of the woods and stabbing your horse, just bizarre, but it's Frost's great wit, and I think, and I'll probably end with this one. It's called Ends, ENDS. Loud talk in the overlighted house that made us stumble past. Oh, where had once been night the first, but this was night the last. Of all the things he might have said, sincere or insincere, he never said he wasn't young and hadn't been his dear. Oh, some as soon would throw it all, as throw a part away. And some will say all sorts of things, but some mean what they say. And, it's great. It's great poetry. And I don't know. I only have 3 minutes left. I don't know if I'll be able to finish this in time, but there was a really, I believe I have it here in this other book. Let me see if I can find it. Oh, this is a wonderful poem, too. There's so many great poems. Hang on a second. I should have had it here.
Sure.